Europe is and always has been sharply focused on peace. They're rational, they're logical, and they are doing everything necessary to end all these wars. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, they're just doing a lot of crazy stuff that doesn't make any sense. President Trump and his team have put out a 28-point peace plan that has been leaked, and Russians are talking a little bit about it. And there's discussions between Witkoff and several of the Russian interlocutors as they try to find a peace. But now, all of a sudden, the minute that that hits public, you have many of the European leaders, especially Kaja Kallas, who's basically the foreign minister of the European Union, throwing cold water on that. And we have other members of the European Union that are trying to throw fire on the thing to burn it up with long-range fires. We're going to get into that in a minute. But to try to make some sense out of all of this, we have back with us today Professor Glenn Deason, professor of political sciences, and also a host of the Glenn Deason YouTube channel. Professor, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back.
Well, listen, you know, that opening dialogue I was given is what it's supposed to be. That's what Europe is supposed to be about, is to getting rid of conflict and to bringing peace in, to using their history and centuries of, sometimes anyway, of diplomatic capabilities and all this education a lot of these folks have. What is going on with this big-time repudiation of even the possibility of reaching a negotiated settlement with Russia?
Well, you're very much correct. Europe is not recognizable anymore. That is, the whole post-World War II European project was supposed to ending wars in Europe by cooperating instead of always going to war and fighting, and essentially looking for security by defeating adversaries on the battlefield. This is what we're supposed to end. And but again, from the European rhetoric, it's, as Kaja Kallas said, there's two goals. First, weaken Russia, and then support Ukraine. This is it. It's just this is what they've been saying for the past years. That is, we just have to weaken Russia enough, defeat it, and then peace will come to Europe. So this is quite a hawkish language. Even now, as the war is obviously starting to come to an end, I mean, it's unraveling rather fast now. And they still want to keep this going.
And just, you know, let me add, I mean, you're obviously there in Europe, so you kind of have your finger on the pulse more than we do over here. What are the conversations like behind the scenes, maybe a little off headlines? Because I can't imagine, but correct me if I'm wrong, I can't imagine that a lot of these leaders actually are unaware of how bad things are on the front. I mean, they can watch a YouTube channel and probably figure it out, much less their intelligence capabilities. But yet, if they are aware of those things and the realities on the battlefield, why the disconnection between what they're saying out loud?
Well, I think they built a narrative on illusions. So there's some people who are very much committed to this narrative, but there's also this underlying concern that this is not the Europe that they wanted to build after the Cold War. Again, after the Cold War, we're going to have a Europe where everyone will be included except for the largest country in Europe, which is Russia. And Russia would kind of orbit at the periphery and do as they're told, but not have a seat at the table. Well, this was a hegemonic Europe, but but that's what the war in Ukraine has been all about. That's what NATO expansion was about, creating a collective hegemony in Europe. And now that we went that extra mile trying to put Ukraine into the orbit, it all failed now spectacularly. We lost the war. Now in the new Europe, Russia will have a say. It's going to be the largest territory, largest population, largest economy, and of course the largest army. So it's going to be impossible to keep the Europeans out. The Russians out, while the Americans seem to be pulling out, not completely, of course, but drawing down some of their forces. So because there's so much at stake, I think rationality has kind of been thrown out the window, whatever bad deal there is on the table, and it is a bad deal. So for the Europeans to recognize that this is not an attractive deal, that's true, but that's pretty much where reason ends, because the deal will only get worse every day that passes by. But Yeah, the Europeans put themselves in this situation.
Well, so I agreed, and you mentioned what Callas said early in this war. That was mirrored, maybe even led by Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who said one of America's objectives was to weaken and harm Russia. I mean, that was one of our outright objectives. I'm talking from the first couple of months of the war. Doesn't appear that it's changed any, even under the new administration. And I get it. That's what you wanted to happen. I would have disagreed with it at the time because I didn't think that it was going to be long term. It was going to be capable because Russia had too many assets and all that we've talked about before. But OK, they thought that and maybe they wanted to give it a shot. They did. And to me, after 2023, after the offensive that the Western side tried to support Ukraine with, which was a complete and total catastrophe, failure in every level you can even imagine. By the fall, when the last of the steam petered out and then Russia went on to the offense around October, November of 2023, and that's where they've been ever since then. I really thought that any rational person, however much they hated Russia, however much they wanted that situation to exist that you talk about to harm Russia, et cetera, how much of you wanted that, at that point, you would have had to say, we did our best. We gave them thousands of armored vehicles, millions of shells of all different calibers, et cetera. They didn't work. They lost huge casualties. They just don't have enough. Russia's getting bigger. All right, let's just get this, you know, cut off right here and end the damage. We'll put whatever good spin we want on it, but let's get this over with and move on. That's what I thought was going to happen. But instead, they literally doubled down and just pretended all that didn't happen. I wonder if you can help us understand the thinking. And let's go back to, the latter part of 2023 in light of the failed offensive when they're deciding what they're going to do next. What was the logic in Europe?
I think the logic was just continuing to weaken Russia. That was no plan B. But you're very correct. I mean, when once the war began, the Russians were taking a lot of casualties. And by November of 2022, this is when General Mark Milley said, after 9 months of fighting, Russia has now been hurt pretty bad. It's taken losses. But this is probably as good as it gets. Now we want to make a deal because from now on, the deal will only get worse pretty much every day that passes. And this is very much true. And of course, as you suggested, 6 months later, it's this disastrous summer offensive. And again, for many people like myself, I made the point, this is going to fail. This is not going to go well. But there's no dissent in Europe. They just push back and say, well, if you're just trying to undermine the public trust and support for the counteroffensive. So, you know, I said the same with sanctions. They're not going to work because this is one of the areas I work on. And then, but again, then you're finding. So, only one line is sent. So, it's called to assess to what extent they actually believe the nonsense that they're all saying. Because if you're not permitted to have any dissent, everyone says exactly the same thing. Then, you know, either people are intimidated and just follow, or they just actually believe the nonsense.
I don't know if you have any access to the inner circle in there, but I mean, I guess if you can just speculate as best you can, given your experience and knowledge, what is going on behind the closed doors? I got it that they're going to give that forward face of, no, we're just going to double down. We're going to do all this stuff. But behind the scenes, it seems to be one of two things is the truth. And give me your view of which or some third option. One is that they have become dysfunctional and literally can't see what's in front of their face. That's one option. I tend to not think that's the one, but who knows? And then the other one is, yeah, we recognize the reality here. We get the battlefield reports like you do, but I'm okay with a bunch of Ukrainian people dying and along because in the process of that, still Russia is getting shot at every day and they're getting blown up and they're getting harmed on their energy infrastructure, et cetera. So let's just keep that going as long as possible. And then at some point, Ukraine's going to fall apart and die anyway. And then we'll figure out what we're going to do on our part and we'll go from there. Or is there some other option? What's happening behind the scenes?
No, it's leaning more now towards the second option, which you outlined. That is, I think a lot of people now increasingly recognizes the disaster which is unfolding. Because until recently, more or less all journalists were compelled to write the same line that Ukraine is winning. But now you already heard, but also, yeah, what you hear from what they're actually talking about, as you said, behind the doors, there are more and more who recognizes how poorly this is going. But it doesn't affect the decision making, as you suggest. We're not fighting with our own soldiers. If we were, we would have looked for peace back in 2022, but we're fighting with Ukrainians. So it's as the EU might say, it's a bit of a bargain because we have hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers fighting on behalf now of NATO. So why would you bring this to an end? Because once you bring it to an end as well, not only would the United States begin to draw down, but even Europe, the unity, solidarity in Europe would also begin to fragment. So it's very reasonable now to expect NATO, EU, all of this to begin to fall apart after this war. So I think so far the goal is they don't have a nice plan B after we lose this war. I think it's just try to weaken Russia as much as possible while we prepare ourselves. And if we lose some Ukrainians along the way, then it's, again, it's not our soldiers. So it's a horrible way of thinking, but this is...
I'm going to ask you a couple of different questions here in light of that. One is what you think the European leadership are thinking, and then the second is what you expect to happen. So first of all, this war will come to an end, either through negotiations or through a battlefield victory on the Russian side. It's one of those two, and I don't see a third option here. All evidence indicates it's going to be a Russian success, either diplomatic or military. If we continue going down the path we are, then the European Union, NATO, and the United States all together are going to have to face a profoundly troubling condition, because at some point, the Ukrainian armed forces, just by math, is going to eventually crumble and collapse. It just won't work any other way. Maybe it'll take a long time. Maybe it'll come in the next couple of months. I can't say with any certainty at all, but it will come. And then what are we going to do? Because then all of the world, not just the European Union, not just the Americans, not just the Russians, but people in Asia, people in South America, I mean, literally all over the place, will go, what in the literal heck? The greatest military alliance in the history of mankind, NATO, couldn't even help one country avoid being destroyed. And now then they've lost that one, and that's on the heels. And now then they're going to pay more attention to Afghanistan, where in 20 years you couldn't even defeat the Taliban. You guys are literally the evidence of a paper tiger that you can't win anything. Are they thinking about that? That's the first question.
I think they're already planning what to say once all of this goes south. And I think the most likely narrative you will see them falling back on is that Russia attempted to wipe Ukraine off the map. They were going to take all of Ukraine. They were only able to end up with, 20%? So this was actually a defeat of Russia. They took a lot of casualties and they failed in their objective. So they're going to have this. This will be the main victory narrative which they will spin. But again, they haven't...
Well, but they can only say that if there is a negotiated settlement, which gives them more incentive to do it now so that they can claim that. But if they don't take this deal on the table here, then they're going to have to deal not with 20%, but with 40 or even more percent.
No, I agree. And this is why I think a negotiated settlement, even along bad terms, is better than a collapse. Because once the collapse comes... What benefit it gives to the Europeans is if there's a collapse, there's no peace agreement, then they can continue feeding Ukrainians into the meat grinder for years to come. They can just do some guerrilla warfare in the back. But if there's no peace agreement, then the Russians will seek security through territorial conquest. So then they will also take Kharkov, they will take Dnipro, they will take Nikolaev, they will take Odessa. So again, those four regions becomes eight, and they could also go further north. They even go after Kyiv. So Sumy, there's a lot of things they can do. But I think the Europeans are still holding on to this idea that if we can just keep the war going, some wonder weapon comes along, a bit more powerful sanction, we go after the Russian energy, just something might crack in Moscow. And in order to keep this going, the most important thing is obviously to get the Americans on board to commit to a forever war with the Russians as well. But this is why it's so strange that they're still going along with this, because because Ukraine now and NATO are losing not just on the battlefield, but the Ukrainian economy is falling apart. the political system is also beginning to unravel, as we see now with these corruption cases. They will begin to turn on each other. International support, of course, is also fading away. These leaders, we said, the Europeans continue to fuel the war, but it's the political leadership. They're immensely unpopular, and we're building up our own legitimacy crisis among our political leadership. So I fully understand the American position. I mean, they initially, as you said, they just used Ukrainians, tried to weaken Russia, maybe even go for a regime change, and it didn't work. So now that a collapse is coming, what do? You hand it over to the Europeans and claim to have made some money of it. You know, Russia's weakened, we sold some weapons, it's not our fault, we tried to make peace. Leave this with the Europeans. So this is also makes a lot of sense. But the European approach, as you see this disaster happening, as there's also all the incentives in the world to find a political settlement, the goal is to keep this going. I know Europeans like Kallas keep saying, we want to strengthen Ukraine to negotiate from a better position. Yeah, I don't really see it, because why? It would be more believable if they didn't boycott diplomacy. They don't talk to the Russians.
Right.
And they whenever they talk about peace in the next sentence, they talk about sending more weapons, pushing more sanctions, making Russia weaker, make them pay a price. I mean, they're looking for capitulation. They want victory. None of this is
all
peace.
And that's all aspirational. It's just like, boy, we cool if... Not there's any actionable plan that has a logical possibility of accomplishing it. So let me ask you the other half of that question. Forget about what the European leaders may want or what their aspirations are. What is your assessment as a European who's also aware of things in Asia and elsewhere in the world, in the event that this collapse scenario does happen, and regardless of whatever spin the West wants to put on it, when you have the smoldering wreckage of the Ukrainian armed forces, or maybe even the Kiev, maybe the regime has fled, et cetera, and it's very clear that Russia has a military victory, whether that's a year from now, 3 years from now, whatever, what do you think is going to be the results, especially looking at the BRICS conglomerate? Because, you know, the people are going to be looking around the world where to put money that they feel is going to be secure and that people are acting rationally, et cetera, maybe in the global south. What impact might this have on people to see that NATO couldn't stop Ukraine from being destroyed?
Well, I think it's first important to know that the Ukrainians themselves are building up some frustration and anger towards the Europeans, because they know that they've been used. Even when the Europeans are speaking very openly about why they're continuing to fuel the war, no one's really believing anymore that they can defeat the Russians unless there's a crack, as I mentioned before. But usually the rhetoric is around weakening Russia and buying ourselves some time. So when you have people like Arostovich, the former advisor of Zelensky, he argues that at some point Ukraine will want to have Zelensky, after he flees the country, delivered back in a cage. He also made the point that if he becomes president, the first thing he would do is go to Russia and promise that Ukraine will never again allow itself to be used as a threat against Russia. So I think that you could see a stabilization there between the Russians and the Ukrainians. But Europe, I think, has exhausted itself in the larger scheme of things. After World War II, of course, we hitched ourselves to the United States. The U.S. after World War II had some very generous trade agreements. We've been able to develop nicely, but at the moment, there's a multipolar system developing, and in this system, the Europeans aren't going to really have a central role, because we cut ourselves off from the Russians. All that energy we got for cheap, all the huge markets which the Russians favored the Europeans, all of this is gone. And then the Americans will also take their focus, their resources, priorities somewhere else. So it's a huge world emerging, and this is translating into actual economic interests. So the Russians will make sure that they will build up a powerful deterrent that will point to the West, towards Europe, and then all their economic connectivity will go to the East. So again, all that cheap energy, which was supposed to go to Europe, that's going to China now, to India. So the Asian economies will be even more competitive now, while the European economies go south. So there's it's very hard to see what kind of role the Europeans will have.
As I understand, you just got back from China, right? It was China?
Yeah, last night.
So what, to the extent that this came up in any of your conversations, how are they viewing this current situation where militarily Ukraine is just starting to collapse at an accelerating rate, and Europeans stay detached from reality on diplomacy? How's that being viewed over there?
Well, I think many see it as in the larger context of how the world is transforming into a more multipolar world, because again, this was unthinkable only a few years ago. If you remember, in the 1990s, NATO's main relationship was with Russia was organized around the idea of managing Russia's perpetual decline, and now, of course, they see the political West with all its military might throwing all its weapons into this war, and they're being defeated by Russia. You know, they're doing everything they can, putting all the sanctions they can, and still, Russia's now the fourth largest economy in the world, according to the World Bank, the largest one in Europe. I think they're seeing Russia as a key partner, preparing now to, well, essentially with China, help to drive forward this multipolar project. Because even if Russia would want to work with the Europeans, they can't because of all the sanctions and the lack of trust. So they see Russia now as a driving force, along with the Chinese, to help to develop a new economic architecture based on new supply chains, new technological centers, industrial hubs, new transportation corridors through the Arctic. You have from Russia, Iran, to India, also, of course, connecting closer with Northeast Asia. They see development of new development banks, trading in national currencies, moving away from SWIFT, because all this war is happening hand in hand with the economic warfare. So, I think it's not Europe's finest moment. I think a lot of the world,
Western world in large. For anybody who may not have seen it, I want to show some examples, because I've been using the term dysfunctional and lack of acknowledgement of reality, et cetera, coming from the European leaders. But lest anybody thinks that I'm exaggerating or making them look worse than they really are, there on your screen, you can see just a couple of days ago, on the 17th, you saw Macron was signing this deal for 100 fighter jets for Ukraine. Well, in about 10 years. And by the way, they can't fly them right now. So you got to start that training process. That is going to have nothing to do with this current war. We already saw that when we tried to do it with the F-16s from the United States, but there they are, glad handed and happy, et cetera. And then now here, I think it was even earlier today, Kaya Kallas is aggravated about this peace plan because it doesn't demand enough concessions from Russia.
In order to end this war, you need the Ukrainians and the Europeans also to agree to those plans. So, Putin could end this war immediately if he just stopped bombing civilians and killing the people. But we haven't seen any concessions on the Russian side. We welcome all the meaningful efforts to end this war. But like we have said before, it has to be just and lasting. That also means that Ukrainians, but also Europeans, agree to this.
So interesting how she emphasizes we're open to any meaningful concessions by the Russian side, et cetera. And that the only definition of that, correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that, if Russia capitulates and surrenders to us, then cool, we'll acknowledge that. Anything short of the concessions that the Europeans want, aside from what the battlefield will permit, that's what they're looking for. And if not, they want to keep pushing.
No, I agree. And I'll just like to say that she points out that Ukraine and the Europeans have to be included in this process. I Ukrainian being, but first thought it was given the proxy war, and the main sides in this proxy war is the United States and Russia. I think it's important that these two great powers first come to an agreement based on the key issues, and then present it to Ukraine and hopefully take it on from there on. But there is no point to include the Europeans. Indeed, if I was advising the Ukrainians, I would say decouple quickly. They they're not there to help you. They're there to continue to keep the war going. They would like to see conscript some even younger Ukrainians to feed into this war. There's no proposal for peace. So why would the Americans or the Russians want to include the Europeans? It doesn't really make any sense. The only thing Kaja Kallas point to is, oh, if Russia really wanted to end the war, they could end it now, just stop fighting, have a ceasefire. But the only reason why we're even considering now accepting Ukraine's neutrality, ending NATO expansion, is because Russia's winning. If you have a ceasefire, the Europeans already said what they want to do. Oh, we can buy some time. We can produce more weapons. We can recruit more Ukrainians into the army. We can feed some long-range missiles in there. We can prolong the war. This is what we're going for. There's a reason why we wouldn't discuss a ceasefire in the first 3 years of the war. But now that the whole thing is falling apart, now we want a ceasefire. We already played this game. That was the Minsk agreement. Just freeze the front line and buy ourselves some time to build up a big army so we can go and kill some more Russians. We've done this before. No, so it's something easy talking points for the media, something to sell the idea that we're there to help Ukraine and Russia is evil and we just have to keep fighting. This is the path to peace.
And there was one more from that same press conference here where she was asked a little bit more about what the Russians could do and how they could bring this to an end, which she said, if all you got to do is agree to this unconditional ceasefire, and it'll be easy.
Of course, for any plan to work, it needs Ukrainians and Europeans on board. So this is very clear. Also, we have to understand that in this war, there is one aggressor and one victim. So we haven't heard of any concessions on the Russian side. If Russia really wanted peace, it could have, agreed to unconditional ceasefire already some time ago.
I'm sorry. I know you kind of addressed this a little bit, but I just cannot bring myself to understand how somebody who is at this high level, even with the hatred of Russia that she probably has from her nationalist days, I just don't see how you can make those kind of comments when you know that the balance of power is so far out of whack against your side that to keep on this path here means that your objectives and your aspirations even are going to have the feet cut out from under them, and that the Ukraine side is just can't do anything except lose, whether they lose slowly or lose fastly. It's only between one of those two outcomes. I don't know. Redundant, I understand. How can this go on?
Well, they're not going to accept defeat, which is why you see this weird dynamic that the worst thing gets on the battlefield, and it's getting really bad now. The more the Europeans have to compensate with the rhetoric, which is why now the Germans are talking about long-range fire into Russia. This is why Macron is signing these deals of, as you said, some fighter jets, 10 years from now. You know, it's never going to materialize. But this is what they do. They beat their chest harder the more they're losing on the battlefield.
And I'm sorry, can you give us a little bit more information on this issue with the Germans from Chancellor Metz? What is it that he's actually offering?
Yeah, it's a bit vague. There hasn't been any commitment yet to the Taurus missiles, because if they come, there's a very good chance that Russia would retaliate directly against Germany. But there's a reason why they start to pledge long-range fire. That is, the Germans want to start striking deeper into Russia. And the reason for this is because the U.S. is pushing this peace plan now. So they have to find a way of balancing it, because, again, if peace breaks out, the party's over for these leaders. So, just another comment on Kaja Kallas, this idea, there's one victor, now there's one victim, there's one aggressor. It doesn't really make any sense at all. And again, the European leaders, as well as the United States, they're the one who backed and engineered the coup in 2014. We already know from the New York Times that on the first day after the coup that the US and the British began to work with the new intelligence services, which they helped install. They built it a new one from scratch to use it as a tool against the Russians. I mean, this is in the New York Times. We also know that they ignored and sabotaged the Minsk agreement for 7 years. They sabotaged the election results in 2019 when 73% of Ukrainians voted for peace platform. They rejected any of the real negotiations with the Russians in 2021. Again, the Istanbul Agreement was sabotaged in 2022. And for 3.5 years, they refused to talk to Russia. They said weapons are the path to peace. We are sending weapons which are operated by Western contractors to attack inside Russia. For God's sake, when we engineered or encouraged the Ukrainians to go invading Kursk, you had German generals on the army, German generals on the TV saying how wonderful this is, how this is going to cause a concern in Russia because this is where German tanks were during World War II and now they're back again. I mean, this is the. Are we really going to go and pretend as if we're just standing on the sideline trying to help Ukraine? I mean, it's beyond absurd. So I think this whole narrative of hers is falling apart very quickly. And the people who claimed moral authority for all of these years now, they're going to be exposed for ignoring all these casualties on the Ukrainian side. They just did anything they could to keep the war going. Because even now, you have a vast majority of Ukrainians who want an end to the war. They're ignoring all of them, and they're pretending to help Ukraine. So it's it's theatrics, but it's coming to an end.
And speaking of ignoring battlefield reality, which we talked about here, I wonder if in the last bit of time we have here before we let you go, if you could talk about the economic realities that they also didn't talk about with these huge scandals of corruption that now have a number of high-ranking officials very close to Zelensky have actually fled the country and are under investigation for hundreds of millions and, in fact, in some cases, billions of dollars of corruption and stealing money. What is the story there?
Yeah, well, everyone knew that, again, the Ukraine was very much very corrupt. But once the Russians invaded, Ukraine had been transformed. Suddenly, there were no longer Nazis, ever free leader. Pretend it wasn't really corrupt all propaganda, but it is profoundly corrupt. But that has also worked to the Europeans' advantage, because if the Ukrainian public would decide, you know, they wouldn't have these military recruiters hunting down men on the street, dragging them out of their houses to send them to the trenches. You would have allowed men to actually leave the country. So you would have also had, with the vast majority of Ukrainians actually wanting an end to the war, you would have had negotiations. You wouldn't have a boycott of diplomacy. So all of this is, should have been obvious. So the corruption worked to the Europeans' advantage in terms of keeping the war going. But the government is now turning on itself. You see it imploding to some extent. And this is to a large extent because of the economic trouble and the corruption. I mean, the Ukrainian economy is on life support. They are now completely dependent on being financed from abroad, from the people who are making their political decisions. So no, things are going very poor, and you see this also on the front line, as you also cover very well. The war of attrition, now suddenly it's not so slow anymore because they can't hold the line. So the Russians are advancing faster and faster every day, which also means that with this fast advancement, they're also able to encircle thousands of troops, Ukrainian troops, which then have to surrender or die, usually the latter. And this only makes the manpower problem worse. So again, economically, corruption, military, across every measurable variable, things are going terribly wrong. And if you think you're going to get a horrible deal, a worse deal tomorrow than you do today, then you sign that deal today. But right. The Europeans, they're living in the fantasy land. They're comparing the bad deal today with the ideal deal, which they make up in their own back room as they pat each other on the back. Russia just pull over, enjoy NATO. Oh, wonderful. Maybe we'll get Russia's natural resources. It's wonderful, but it belongs in La La Land. It's not real.
Yeah, it does. It would belong in a bad Hollywood movie because it would be so unrealistic. No one would actually make that movie. But unfortunately, that's the reality that we have to navigate in. Well, listen, we're unintimidated and uncompromised to tell people the truth, whatever it is. And sometimes that's an unpleasant truth like we're doing today. But it's something that people need to know. Because we don't need to be sending any more money, good money after bad. We don't need to keep going down a path that can't succeed, et cetera. And people need to know this. And so in that regard, we're very grateful for you coming on, your clarity with talking about these issues very much from the European perspective. Thank you for coming on.
Anytime.
And there, as a reminder here, go to Glenn Deason on his YouTube channel, all kinds of things that are interesting there. And we will be looking for that ourselves. I actually look at that sometimes too. So thank you very much for that.
Thanks.
And we will be looking forward to seeing you. Listen, we got about 45 minutes or so from now, a show you, a promise you don't want to miss. And it's going to be Dr. John Gartner, who is an expert in the field of dementia and several other kinds of related medical issues here. And there is some serious information and evidence that President Trump is, in fact, suffering a cognitive decline. This is not a pejorative. This is not a trash Trump situation at all. But it is now hampering his decisions and making and his decision making on issues on foreign policies and war making issues that is very alarming. When you see what he has to say today, you're going to see this is a much more serious issue than you may have realized. That's going to be today at 3:15 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.